Welcome back to this bi-weekly meeting of the Budget and Policy Committee of Denver City Council. Join us for the discussion as the Budget and Policy Committee starts now.
Hi, everybody. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
I'm Amanda Sandoval, Council President, and we have a cool agenda tonight this afternoon. Tonight we have a long agenda, but I'm excited to have in front of us today. So let's go around the room and then we'll get started with Councilmember Lewis and then we'll go to Councilmember Hines. But let's start with introductions on my left.
That's me. Hi. Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver.
Good afternoon. Daryl Watson, representing the Fine District 9.
Jamie Torres, West Denver District 3.
Chantel Lewis, Councilwoman for District 8, sorry.
Amanda Sawyer, District 5.
Laura Alvidres, West Lucky District 7.
Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver's District 2.
Chris Hines, Denver's Perfect 10.
Sarana Gonzalez Gutierrez, one of your council members at large.
Perfect. So let's get started, and I will pass it over to Councilman Lewis and your staff. Councilmember Cashman.
Haircut.
Oh, Councilmember Cashman, want to introduce yourself?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Paul Cashman, South Denver District.
You look very distinguished, Councilmember. You got a little haircut there. All right. Go ahead, Lewis.
Introduce himself and the organization as well that he's with.
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Rashawn Bliss. I am the Director of Democracy Innovation for a national network called the National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation. I'm going to be talking to you about citizen assemblies today, along with a bunch of my friends who are hopefully joining on the Zoom from other civic organizations that have been talking with the councilwoman and the mayor about a civic assembly here.
Yes. Thank you. Uh-huh.
Great. Let's move that they're showing up under. I promise I'm not in more than one place at a time.
You all don't take the opportunity to introduce yourselves. You just have to come on.
Yeah. We'll start, Kale.
Sure. Hi. I'm not Roshan. I am Kale McMonagle. I am a collaboration director with the Civic Canopy. We work across the state working to support collaborative efforts to strengthen our civic culture. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jillian Youngblood. I'm the Director of Deliberative Democracy for the National Civic League. We have an office, and our president actually is based in Denver, so we're there a lot. And we run a variety of processes, including civic assemblies, that help constituents and elected officials and governments work together better. Thanks for having us.
And hi, everyone. I'm Lauren Babcock. I'm with Healthy Democracy. We're based out of Oregon, but we work nationally and sometimes internationally organizing civic assemblies, organizing and advocating for civic assemblies.
For me, too.
Can't until the top of the hour.
Great. Thank you all for the opportunity to introduce yourselves. I wanted to let you all know as well that we will have your ears are so cute. We will have another person joining us for questions as well. That's Ramin. And so once he's online, I'll let you all know. In terms of starting with the agenda, I'm going to give you all some background on what a civic assembly is and how it works and why I think it's a good idea. And then I'll go to your questions. I do want to start with, this is mostly a briefing that's informational. At this point, it could inform a future ordinance or a ballot measure for a charter change to set up the process for how civic assemblies may be called and implemented. There's also currently a proposal for a civic assembly that is sitting in the mayor's office, but this briefing here is just to familiarize you all with the concept. There should be time for us to there should be an opportunity for us to briefly discuss the Denver proposal after the briefing, but before we take any questions, if you all are interested in the contents of that proposal. Thanks. All right. So what is a civic assembly? A civic assembly brings together a diverse group of residents selected through a civic lottery. Delegates are given, and so they're called delegates. Delegates are given time, information, and support to learn about the issue, to hear from a full range of perspectives. Deliberate together and craft informed recommendations that reflect a broad community support. And we'll talk in more detail about what that looks like. So we're going to go through each of these pieces a bit more detail in a moment, but I really wanted to make one thing clear. A civic assembly is like a legislative body of everyday citizens. Its makeup ought to be representative of the people, and its recommendations ought to be implemented as if they were a part of a decision-making body, which I think is really important to note. This is not an advisory body. This is a meaningful public participation and engagement. So why a civic assembly? As you can see from the diagrams, the creation of a civic assembly creates true flow and dialogues between the public, stakeholders, and advocates, and the decision makers. In contrast with the traditional way that we do things, where interested parties and stakeholders often dictate what should be done to the decision makers. This can be especially useful when the issue in question is controversial, going to the citizens to make tough decisions on what ought to be done instead of hearing from competing interest groups can help difficult divides in communities because the communities come together to make a decision. And as I just said, the civic assembly is not an advisory group, which I think is really important. Ideally, it should not have representatives of other elected bodies serving on it, but should be treated as an equal power by the decision makers for the topic area of the civic assemblies anyway. Anything you want to add, Rashawn?
No, so far this is great.
All right. All right. He'll let me know if he changes his mind. So I've been speaking generally so far, but let's go into some of the numbers that back this up. A 2020 report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, of 700 plus civic assemblies around the world found that A, recommendations of civic assemblies are backed by the members of the assembly, representative of the larger public, by 70% or more, a supermajority, which I know is important to us on this body, and B, the OECD report found that civic assemblies were suited to building trust across divides. 2014, Ireland Civic Assembly on Abortion broke years of deadlock over the issue, paving the way for a nationwide referendum to legalize abortion. So 87% support for civic assembly members to refer the measure. In Oregon, they held a civic assembly on how the state should respond to COVID. And while initial meetings were tense, the eventual recommendation of the panel came with 79% support of the assembly, and the members of that panel by the end came to understand other perspectives and rationales than they otherwise would have. The OECD reports also found that civic assemblies tend to be flexible in their recommendations, ranging from short-term fixes to long-term solutions in the long run based on the topic area. For example, say we have a civic assembly on housing here in Denver. The civic assembly could, after hearing from experts, make recommendations on how to build more affordable housing in Denver in the short term, while also making recommendations on land use changes that may be needed in the future. And so the scope can be very flexible with civic assemblies. Internationally, Ireland, which I just mentioned as an example, Belgium decided to do a climate assembly. Paris has a standing assembly. And the U.S., I mentioned Oregon, as well as California and Fort Collins, which I had the opportunity to go to the civic assembly in person. And that's where I ran into Rashawn, and we have been locked at the hip since. I should mention that in Fort Collins, this was a decision to decide to what to do with Hughes Stadium. And I was initially thinking about a civic assembly for the Park Hill Golf Course. And I was realizing that while that was a contentious issue, we have bigger problems to deal with. And it could definitely be more citywide focused instead of District 8. Y'all know I love my district, so I wanted to think more expansively. Past topics of assemblies around the world have included urban planning, health, the environment, strategic planning, infrastructure, and hopefully this makes it clear for you all that the Civic Assembly is a flexible instrument and that it can be used to cover hot button topics, which I encourage us to do. All right, so we've talked about the background. Let's talk about the mechanics. Each civic assembly has three key elements to reach solutions: the who, what, and how. Who: participants in an affected area, in this case, citywide neighborhoods, are selected by a civic lottery. Think about in the same way that you might be summoned for jury duty. The what is these participants are provided stipends from their time to learn about the nuances of the topic area and then deliberate in depth with their fellow assembly persons over the course of multiple meetings. And the flexibility is built in there as well, because you get to decide what the multiple meetings looks like. And then the how is the civic assembly produces recommendations based on 70% or more agreement on an issue, which I think is an important number as well. So let's look at these in turn. There's a two-step process for selecting the civic assembly by lottery. A, invitations are sent to random households in the targeted area. The number of invitations will scale based on budget, size of issues, et cetera. So there's flexibility in there, and depends on how much money you have. And then using the same system that the city uses to inform people for zoning changes, for example, to be able to get that information out. Recipients of the invitations opt in, and so you receive the invitation, and you get to decide if you'd like to participate or not. The city can provide multiple methods for that opt-in, so you can mail in, email responses, text, et cetera, so there's some flexibility in there as well. And the invitation process will also raise awareness of an issue and attempts to come to a solution. And so broader notification than what can be achieved using, like, the traditional communication methods or that a council member may use, or a mayor's office. Anything there?
The
expert. I'm complaining.
I am one of the experts, along with my colleagues. But the only thing I'd add is that the opt-in is not just if you opt in, then you get to join. Then there's one last stage where the people who are administering the assembly actually build a series of demographically representative panels that the decision-making body can choose from. So it's not just you opt in, now you're part of it. You opt into a pool that then we use to construct a room full of Denver that looks as closely mapped onto Denver's demographics as we can. And that can include things like how they what their stance is on whatever issues up for debate.
Thank you. So once the assembly selection is finalized, the body will come together and learn and then deliberate. And they can also request additional information if they feel like they're missing something. The panelists are given enough time for all of this, typically over the course of multiple all-day sessions, so 4 to 8 days total, but you can scale. It just depends on the budget and things that I mentioned earlier. Again, which I think is an important piece, the delegates are paid for their time, like jury duty, but better. Much better. We have a cost estimate of what this could look like in the appendix, and so you all can look there. But the main thing is that this isn't done in a day or in an hour. The assembly is guided by professional facilitation to ensure respectful and balanced dialogue and to handle logistical issues that may arise. But the facilitator doesn't have any say over the final recommendations made by the assembly. It could ultimately be facilitated by a city agency empowered to do this kind of facilitation. So you could actually have a Department of Civic Assemblies, which is my dream, as well, and to be able to bring this into the city, and so that you might save some time and some money on hiring consultants to do this kind of work for us. Good. Okay. The decisions are made by a supermajority, which I mentioned earlier, so that 70% or greater of the total assembly. That's like getting 10 votes on council, essentially. Solutions are made with broad-based balance, what is practical while also allowing the inclusive recommendations. Supermajority recommendations by citizens will help shore up public trust and acceptance of the outcomes. And they found that in the past assemblies that have taken place as well. Is there anything that you want to say about the supermajority recommendation?
Just that it helps you back up the, you know, whatever outcome is coming from the assembly, whatever recommendation is there. It's always going to be the thing that a representative group of body of Denverites think is the best move, and it's like a better than a public opinion poll, because they've actually had a chance to engage with it. So it's very, very rare that the outcomes of citizen assemblies aren't supported by the broader public.
Thank you. So I wanted to go into some detail about the public engagement and information committee part of the civic assemblies, since these are crucial to the learn and deliberate part of the process that I mentioned earlier. There's really two parts to this. First, there is the public testimony. The civic assembly can hear from outside experts, can hear from those in the public who want to make their voices heard on an issue. They can hear from the interest groups, the businesses, academics, et cetera, et cetera. But again, those groups are not in control of what the assembly ultimately recommends and are there to give testimony only. Second, there is an independent information committee, which is the panel of experts brought in to provide insight and information for the topic area. And so we'll look at this in more detail on this next slide. The information committee is an independent committee that curates presenters and materials for the assembly to use in learning and deliberation. As an example, a civic assembly on housing affordability information committee would include housing experts, developers, financiers, nonprofits, advocacy groups, and I'm sure I missed some, but you all understand it. The city can provide agency experts on the information committee, but unlike the way that the city conducts other business with the public, those agencies aren't in the driver's seat. They are just one group of experts. The city can provide agency experts, but unlike the way that the city conducts other businesses with the public, those agencies aren't in the driver's seat. They are just one group of the experts, and they can also hear from outside experts, and again, they can request additional information if they find that something is missing. So this is an example of the assembly. Did I miss something? Okay. This is an example, a schedule for the assembly, which will vary on the topic area and the size of the assembly itself. The main thing is that there are multiple instances to meet and deliberate to build trust and cohesion in that body and to make a democratic recommendation at the end of the assembly. The assembly makes their recommendation, and then it is up to the decision-making body to implement those recommendations. And I will note, and Roshan will probably strangle me if I don't, that up front, either the mayor's office or the council body has to make a commitment that they will implement the recommendations that come from the delegates, which is a really important piece as well. The OECD has found that most decision-making bodies do in fact implement at least a portion of the recommendations that are made. For example, Fort Collins. At the start of the process, the council passed a resolution committing to implementing the recommendations of the panel. Future ordinances or charter change could specify means by which the council, the mayor, must or may implement the recommendations of a civic assembly. Implementation could look like any of the following. So formal resolutions or ordinances to implement the recommendations, ballot questions where necessary on recommendations, some kind of public accounting on why recommendations are not implemented. Go to the next one. Thank you. So a randomized selection is more representative than a meeting of the most passionate individuals who habitually show up to the city council public comment, which we are all familiar with. Decisions made by community involve cultural and historical nuances that a consultant might not recognize. It's easier to bridge divides on policy opinions when we are sharing a space and recognizing one another's common humanity. And then co-governance, which you all have heard me talk about that. This is the spirit of democracy. So I just wanted to leave you all with this quote from the Fort Collins mayor. I'm going to read it, but you guys can read. That's how you got on council. So, the Fort Collins Civic Assembly came together to to deliberate long and hard and very fairly came up with a recommended solution that we feel is probably a better one that fits most Fort Collins than in the city. I just listened to several different activist groups that are highly engaged, and I would imagine we've never seen that before. So before we turn it over to questions, I wanted to let Ramin is on as well, briefly discuss the affordable housing civic assembly proposal that is with the mayor's office, and we have included some of it in the appendixes, in the appendix related to this proposal. But if you wanted to, okay.
Well, thank you, Councilwoman. I think it's just really important for us to be discussing ways that in this time that we can actually be deepening and expanding the democracy that we are experiencing here in Denver. I am one of those people who's deep, highly engaged, and y'all hear from me a lot. I've been here 15 years. I know many of you personally. And assemblies are a way for us to make sure that the people who are the regular, the usual suspects are not the only ones who have your ears. We have been, but while I'm one of the usual suspects, I've been advocating with the councilwoman, with a few of you, and with the mayor's office to encourage Denver to use this innovative democratic process to show, I think that, you know, in this moment where so much of our country is really concerned about the slippage in democracy, and the ways that people are further and further away from any decision, any meaningful say in how things work in their world, their city, their country. This is a way for us to actually do that and show the rest of the country in the way that we've shown them with lots of other innovations, what can be done to answer those kinds of challenges. We have been advocating for the city to use a citizen assembly on some sticky question that has been struggling to make its way through the regular policymaking pipeline and through conversations with the mayor's office and with Councilwoman Lewis. Several people have, we've kind of been circling around the area of affordable housing and thinking about how we can engage regular Denverites in real decision-making around this. It's kind of like we encourage people to think about it like a jury, where instead of a criminal legal decision that a jury is making, a citizen assembly is being given a civic or policy issue to decide, and they get more support, certainly a better stipend than the like $50 a day or whatever we get now. And it results in outcomes that universally loved is too strong, but are very, very strongly accepted and promoted by both the people who are part of them, the governments and leaders who ask for the citizen assemblies to come into existence, and the public that are represented by them. I think that's all I'd say.
And with that?
I have myself and my colleagues are all here, and we're happy to answer questions that you all might have, because we just threw a lot at you. I'm sure you've got some wonderings about how it could actually work.
Awesome. Thank you. This is something I've thought about a long time, is figuring out how do you get diverse voices at the table, because you get the same people who get your newsletter, you get the same people who show up at your RNO. My staff goes to my RNO meetings every month, and it's usually the same 6-7 people, the same people who come to public comment. But how do you get the attention of the public? I think that's something where planners, like at UC Denver at the School of Architecture and Planning, have been discussing this for years now. It was hard pre-COVID, and now it's even hard after COVID. So always happy to learn more and figure out how to get more public involvement. Feels like people only get involved until something happens to them, right? Mm-hmm. Until like a bike lane is gonna go in front of your house, or a zoning change is coming, or something's happening. And this is the idea of co-creation, right? Be more proactive. And I think that's one of our hardest jobs on city council, is how do you turn this work to proactive instead of reactive? Because you could spend your whole time being a council person being reactive instead of proactive. So I see this as a very proactive approach. With that, I have Councilwoman Alvidrez, Hines, Pro Tem Romero Campbell, Flynn, and Torres in the queue, and then Watson. So Councilwoman Alvidrez, start us off.
Awesome, thank you. This is so on brand for you. I thought about the co-governance right away. I could hear your voice in my head already. But, This is exciting. I personally obviously have a shorter time in government than council president and haven't heard of this before, but it's definitely an issue that I've seen, especially like with the Southwest area plan. So many people, we've been knocking doors to make sure people are aware, and we're already at the final draft and people have no idea that this is happening. And so it is a really big issue. And I also feel the frustration of all the task force the mayor has put on recently, where he doesn't listen to any of their input. And so that is concerning, because I feel like the thing that really spoke out to me was how you talked about building trust across divides and with governance and government. But one thing I think about when I think about the people that are donating a lot of their time, which is the usual people that are like on every task force. There's the same people on the CBA for the soccer stadium, as the same people are on the Southwest Area Plan, there's the same people that are on all the things that we're doing. And how do we get those people that don't feel like they have the time? And I think a big part of that is pay. So has that been part of the conversation? Like, we need to pay people for their time, especially if we want those diverse voices.
Yes, and that was actually really important. And Rashawn can speak to it from examples, but that is included in the, as a part of the proposal. So the living wage is well, maybe I'll have Rashawn speak to it specifically about what it is, but it's much better than what you might anticipate.
Yeah, the idea is that all of these folks should get a living hourly wage for their service as delegates. Certainly, you know, a huge part of the question of people participating is time, which means they have to get some kind of money if it's going to be a lot of time. But it's also agency. It's will this make a difference? You're right that so many people are so frustrated by the experience of being on an advisory council or advisory body that doesn't get listened to. And they just think, why did I give all that time? So we answer that in two ways in civic assemblies. One is because you got paid well. You would get in our proposal, the living wage proposition is that we give them $35.29 an hour. For over 50 hours of work. At the minimum wage, it would be $19.29 an hour. If it starts next year, it'd be a little higher, I think.
But we don't want to go minimum.
We don't. But the idea is make it worth people's time for the funding, but also because this really is going to do something, that they're going to be able to see their time and expertise translated into change.
I appreciate that. And then I also think, like, as a mom, I would like my kids or my family to be included. So, you know, if we have a family dinner, that often means, like, for me and my job, I will say, like, if you guys want to see me, you got to come to the community meeting, then we'll go work afterwards. Or I bring my son, you know, and so, and I think one thing that's frustrating is I'll bring my family, but they don't necessarily have the same input that I do. So I think allowing that and thinking about parents and people that are caring for elders would be helpful. And then one of the things that I didn't understand about what was said was where you said they're not a governing, they're advisoring, but we need to treat them as an equal, and we are governing. So how do we say you're not governing, but I'm treating you as an equal and I'm governing?
So they are the governing body for the recommendations, okay. But they would make the recommendations to the us, like as council members, mm-hmm. and or to the administration.
Okay, so they are a governing body, but only for that one particular issue or topic.
Correct, okay. Yeah.
Then go back to the jury model, where the judge is the person who has the power in the room, but the jury tells him what to do.
And I know you mentioned not having those overrepresented groups that are always, you know, we always hear from them. I didn't understand how we make sure that they're not the only people, like maybe they still get a chance to participate, but not the same.
Yeah, they tend to participate as the panel. Panel of information. Okay, there we go. I was like, I might have made that up, but for the panel of information, because we do want them to still hear the myriad of perspectives on an issue. We just don't want them to. We want the
deciding.
Exactly right. And I have to laugh because you said it, Councilmember Alvidrez, as well as Councilmember Sandoval. And I was with a bunch of electeds over the weekend, and one of them used the acronym STP, and I was like, what is that? And she said, the same 12 people. It's like the same 12 people that show up to the meetings. So now you have that in your lexicon.
Thank you. Next up, we have Councilmember Hines and then Romero Campbell on deck.
Thank you, Council President. Thank you for the presentation. I wrestle with this as well. I want to thank Councilmember Cashman, who's online, Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez, for the continued conversation about our registered neighborhood organization process. I know I hired a consultant in 2021, 2022 to figure out how the District 10 office could better connect with the constituents. We spent about $20,000-$30,000 researching how to do that. We came up with a neighborhood delegates process where each of our statistical neighborhood would have two delegates, except for our most populous neighborhood, which is Cap Hill. We would have four delegates. And so, as Council President mentioned, that there are, you know, and SDP, the same 12 people who show, at least in District 10, there are also folks who, I think, as Council President mentioned, there's a bike lane that goes in front of their house or business, and suddenly they're interested and engaged, and they're all over city government, but they have no idea how to approach government. And so part of the process that I was going to do for these neighborhood delegates was also give them a training on how to engage with local government. And so I wonder if that's part of your thought process, or the part of the process that you have now.
Yes, people certainly get trained to participate in the assembly itself, but in broader government, that's not something that we expect to give them training on. Just like, here's how how to advocate. Yeah. We will help them understand how a bill becomes law, but it's also issue by issue. I'd love actually to turn this over to one of my colleagues, Lauren Babcock from Healthy Democracy, who's actually ran the Citizen Assembly up in Fort Collins, to talk about this piece.
Thank you.
I wonder if we can get the help from the producers on that.
Yep. That I'm really passionate about as well, because like you said, so many people are interested, and civic engagement is kind of like a black hole of information. They don't know the first step to take. They don't know what to do to be heard, or if it's going to matter if they are. And so part of the way that I think about civic assemblies is that, much in the way that we are consumers in the world, we are presented with consumer information. It's put in front of our face, whether we like it or not, and whether or not we seek it out. The invitation to the civic assembly is put in front of people, whether they ask for it or not. And a lot of times that's the impetus that people need to get involved. So it creates it, and it opens a pathway for people that they don't have to actively seek out themselves, especially because they oftentimes don't know how to actively seek it out themselves. Mm-hmm. And as far as further civic engagement, like Rashawn said, there isn't any specific training, but they do become much more familiar, I think, with the idea of civic engagement, much more confident and passionate about the concept of it moving forward. And they become familiar with working with, the governing body who initiates the assembly, like the city council, or the speakers from the information committee, or the public and different experts and stuff like that. So we have certainly seen an increased interest and ability in civic engagement after assemblies.
Last thought process. I'm glad that you're bringing this up. This, we actually did something very similar a year ago, and I guess I didn't know what to call it. We hired another consultant to help with facilitation, and the goal was to determine how we could better engage the people of District 10. We have the youngest, so District 10 is a center city district. Is the youngest median age. More than half of the people who live in District 10 are millennials. And so it's about 55%, something like that. So so speaking, people want to get engaged. They're getting to the age where they're putting down roots, having kids, buying property, and they're they don't know how to engage. And so I sent a My goal was to have a 90-minute conversation over one evening. There were multiple cohorts, but each time commitment was only 90 minutes. I sent out an email to my newsletter, which was about 25,000 email addresses in District 10. We got a really low response rate. And then on top of that, once we got the response, the people who were willing and interested, We gave it to the consultant who came up with us to a demographic representative of the district. And even then, that night, the limited invitations that we gave, less than half of the people actually showed. And it turns out a lot of them were SDP, same 12 people. So so I'm really interested in, you know, we tried the process and it was maybe, I am like one of those people that I was talking about where I was trying something, I have no idea what I was doing. So I'd be curious to learn more about, you know, how you get people, you know, to respond and people who are interested. You know, I think people aren't interested until, government finds their way to their front door with the bike lane or something like that. So very interested in the process. We haven't had a whole lot of success with it in the past, but maybe it's because we're not using you.
But I'm happy to talk with you more about how to get people to respond. But the short version is these civic assemblies, they get people to respond because it's actual power. Just like with the participatory budgeting process that we piloted, when you give people real decision-making power, they show up.
And I think it's important also that the compensation is important. I mean, as Councilwoman Alvidrez pointed out, and that's not often happening when we are inviting folks on committees or task force, that we are sometimes not even providing them with meals, let alone childcare or interpretation or a stipend that is a living wage.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Public engagement leading up to this election and the invitations going out that are really important. And this is especially to reach out to diverse communities who may be mistrusting of the city or of governing bodies for whatever reason. And that in itself and talking to them directly can increase the response rate. We also go through three stages of selection. So we have the initial selection and then we have a reselection for those who were selected but could no longer be available. And then we have alternates who show up on the first day, just in case people who committed didn't show up that day. Then we have people available to step in as needed.
Yeah, and I'll just add one more detail by way of example. The Civic League is working on a civic assembly right now in Raleigh, North Carolina. And they have a quite big public outreach operation just to help people understand there is a thing called an assembly. People do not typically know what these are. It is worth your while for these reasons. It's different than all of the other things where they say, come give your opinion, and you speak for 3 minutes at the mic and go sit down. Certainly the compensation is part of it, but I think the real nut of it is people understanding that they have a tangible impact on policy. Mm-hmm. And in Raleigh, the community outreach team that is part of the city government is spending a lot of time right now in historically underrepresented communities. So they are making sure that they're really on the ground, explaining to community leaders and social service agencies and all of the places where you find people who are less likely to respond to an email or to even be on your email list. They're really reaching out to those folks early before the invitations even go out. And just to put a little point on the invitations themselves, these are physical paper invitations that go to your mailbox. So we all know that there's a kind of person who's on your email list, and you're going to reach a lot more people when they physically get an invitation that comes to their home.
Appreciate all that. Thank you, team.
That's great.
Now we're running low on time.
All right. Next up, I have Council Romero Campbell with Council Member Flynn on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward. I'm a big fan of civic assemblies. I sit on the National Civic League Board, and this is one of the strategies one of the assembly kind of projects that they have moving forward, like you just heard from Jillian. I spoke with the mayor of the civic assembly. I can't remember the name of the town, but it was in California. And one of the takeaways from that conversation was being very specific, kind of getting to your question, Council Member Alvidrez, about how do you do that balance? And one of the recommendations that she had talked about was really being able to figure out what is the question and having that question determined and agreed upon, not only with their, you know, with leadership, with council, with mayor, et cetera, to be able to narrow it down, because there is a process of I'm committed then to moving forward. So can you talk a little bit about how you plan on looking at the question, or like how those things kind of come up as well?
Yeah.
Or how, what you're thinking? I know you gave an example for housing and also Park Hill. I know we had also had that conversation about when the bond proposals had come through. There were like four different, we were on that committee, there were like four different proposals for public restrooms as well. And I'm not saying that that should be the issue of this one, but like public restrooms, like there are people from all over the city that are asking the same question. But I just was wondering what you were thinking about for this particular process.
Do you want to share?
No, go.
So
I'll chime in.
Yeah, there's the what question the Civic Assembly is pointed at is the most important piece of the whole process. And I actually love to turn this over to my colleague, Ramin Sarabi from the American Public Trust, who I believe has joined the call. He's been an advisor on several different kinds of public assemblies and civic engagement processes. Ramin, are you there?
Here he is.
I'm glad to be here with you again. American Public Trust, we work with cities, counties, oftentimes state, on citizen assemblies and larger deliberative methods, oftentimes technology enabled as well. In terms of issue selection, it's some combination of being top of mind and meaningful enough to the residents of a place. I would not recommend something like if I heard about bathroom placements. That could be contentious. But again, the highest service of these is where it's helping resolve a very meaningful issue for the broader public. And then two is you've got to have the issue scoped in a way where it's tractable in the amount of time that you have to offer the citizen representatives for the process. So that's on average 50 hours, which is to say you're not going to solve homelessness or a complex systemic issue in 50 hours. But you could bite off a chunk of that, maybe something about rules and policies with how, you know, zoning impacts folks that are unhoused. And I'm using this as an example off the cuff. And similarly with affordable housing, it would be some subset of that. Now, the choice of the issue on some level is also a political decision. There needs to be openness in the policymaking cycle to integrate the recommendations so they can actually drive impact, because, you know, I'm sure we've seen this through public engagement broadly. If you're just gathering people's voice and it doesn't lead to action, you're better off having not done it. You're actually diminishing trust. So, you know, I'm giving some of the different contours here, but it's a very solvable problem. And through guidance of expert practitioner groups like Healthy Democracy, like National Civic League, every time you can find a good way forward.
Thank you.
And I'll just add to that, that the conversations that we've had in the proposal with the mayor's office is around housing, the topic of housing. And you're right, regarding wanting to get very specific, not super specific, but getting very granular with the question that is being asked. That was actually one of the learnings that I had from the folks that I had spoken to in Fort Collins, was to get to that level of specificity. But in all transparency, in the proposal, we've been talking housing.
Yeah. I think how that comes down, especially if when I was looking at the slide deck, and I can't remember what slide it was on, but it's that conversation back and forth. Okay, if there needs to be then be the, if I understand this correctly, if there needs to be, if there is a proposal at the end or recommendations, it's this body, the council or the mayor, I think those would be the two entities that would say, hey, we take these recommendations, or they're, or having the justification of like, no for these recommendations and what have you, having that very specific. And I'm almost wondering if even housing is, could be more refined to let people know what the direction is if we're doing citywide.
It certainly would.
Yeah, it has to be. It's kind of broad now because no decisions have been made, at least from the proposal that's within the mayor's office. I'm happy to share that proposal. Like, it's, I'm happy to give that to any council member who wants to read in more detail about what that looks like.
Thank you.
And then I just had one other question about when I just lost my question. Hold on.
Go ahead and go through.
I think you maybe you answered it, but I'll talk with you, or I'll ask you more online.
Okay. And I will be offering briefings as well with Rashawn and folks on this call. So
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up, Councilmember Cashman.
Councilmember Flynn. Sorry, PK.
It's your Halloween costume.
I know.
I read the queue in the chat, and then I read Cashman's name last night.
I know we have another presentation, so I'll just lay out my questions. I need a lot more information. Particularly on those, in 2021, there were 36 assemblies. Maybe could we get a report out on them? Among my questions are, you know, to pick a committee or an assembly of just random folks who may have no knowledge. You know, the expression drinking from the fire hose comes to mind. In the topic that's going to be discussed, and they're being selected simply because they might fit the demographic range that we're trying to achieve, and to expect them to come up with recommendations that could be millions and millions of dollars in three meetings, three weekends, or however long the time is, kind of gives me some pause. And also, how are the members of the information committee selected? Because that, you know, we are often steered by staff here, as we all know, and we like to think we know a lot more than my neighbor two doors down who might get your letter, right? So I have a high degree of skepticism to start. So I just need a lot more data and information. Sure. So, and I know we need to move on, so I'll jump out.
So what I'm going to ask is that all of you just ask your questions if you can. Is that okay, Councilman Lewis? And then you can collect them, and then we can bring this back another time. Okay, so Councilmember Torres.
Thank you. I'm wondering how you see this either replacing or augmenting the way that we currently use community-seated committees. They could be advisory boards. They could be a community advisory committee for small area plan or a neighborhood planning initiative, if that's the context for using civic assemblies. The other one is, some of this feels a little similar to the people's budget process. Yeah. What are the differences? Are they similar, just a different question or scope or something like that? And I think those, thinking about, is it a citywide policy or is it a neighborhood impact question? How might those be treated differently? Mm-hmm. Would be really interesting to me. And then how long have they taken, and how much budget has that required? That might lead to Councilman Flynn's question with some of the examples. I was reading through the Fort Collins report. Super fascinating, super interesting. I might have a former stadium site, right? Like, it's not as big. It's 80 acres, not 164. Thank you. Willing to follow up.
Awesome. Councilmember Watson.
And thank you, Council President. My questions will go around the same, a lot more information. I read through the Hughes Civic Assembly report as well, and understanding the juxtaposition with the current process that we have, I chaired the initial housing advisory board, and that wasn't just an opt-in. There was an equity process through the city's review of folks, not just demographics, but individuals living with, who are currently unhoused, folks who are dealing with housing instability, a whole host of factors that the city requires. That committee helped to create a five-year plan that governed, targeted all of our implementation of housing, and then an annual action plan. These are things that are embedded. It's not just give input and be ignored. It's, so would this transform, replace that very competent group of folks, and also the requirement for expert input on kind of the actions within the five-year action plan wasn't just created by these folks in 50 hours. I mean, this was a 18-month process and required each part of that to be scrutinized by experts in the field. I just need a little bit more information. The Hughes study provided very high-level things that would not have impacted, like housing would impact. how we do housing in Denver. So I just need a lot more info, and I look forward to getting that information.
You want examples of other civic assemblies? Is that what you're asking for?
I need clarity on, does this replace, let's say, the Housing Stability Strategic Advisors Board? It's an advisory board that creates a very clear, actionable action plan that governs hundreds of millions of dollars and directs city policy for the next 30 years. Would this assembly on housing replace their input, which is informed through housing policy and has an equity approach that goes beyond demographics?
So, thank you. The one question that I have is, in Fort Collins and the other places that you've listed, they had their mayor sits on city council with them. It's not a mayor strong form of government, which makes us always really hard when I'm talking to other elected officials. We're such a unicorn in that way. So it's usually that mayor made that announcement, but they probably made it from when they were meeting at city council when they were working on this. And as we all know in this room, that does not happen here. And so where have civic assemblies happened where we have a strong mayor form of government? And if you don't, if you can't find it, something close. Because oftentimes, all of that work that we've done, it has a fiscal note to it. And so we can pass legislation. We can't implement it. And that's the harder thing about having a more strong form of government is we pass things on to the administration, and it's all via interpretation. And I'll just say the reason why I say that is because Councilmember Cashman years ago did a budget amendment for the report that led to the Office of Neighborhood Safety and RNO reform. It took years for the mayor to actually implement that and then do the study, and now I think that the implementation of that report looks, in my opinion, very different than that report came out at UC Denver. It's not the same, but it's because the executive branch has the authority to make that decision, and we don't. We can just pass the contract. So that's where I would be interested in understanding how the fiscal note plays more into and the difference between the executive branch and city council. This rezoning is simple. That's under our purview. We can do that, right? That's why I ran crazy with ADUs, because I was like, watch me. I'm not need your permission to get this done. And so that was easy for me to tackle with gentrification and displacement in Northwest Denver. That's why I really studied that. So that would just be my interest. And then Councilman Lewis, if you want to find a time on budget and policy and come back, and love to learn more. And then if you could send the proposal around to all of us, I can opine on that too.
I do.
Okay, yep. Awesome. Thank you all.
Does that have the questions?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
All right. Next. Oh, Councilmember Cashman. Councilmember Cashman.
Thank you very much, Madam President. I appreciate that. Councilwoman Lewis, really appreciate you bringing this forward. You know, this council in the past few years has been extremely clear in wanting to move way past simple community engagement to community empowerment. And the Civic Assembly is certainly a tool that has that potential. And I think the details of how it works and who gets on what board can be ironed out. But I think the main thing that we've yet to see is something Madam President just spoke of. And that is, as I say, council's very clear. We want community empowerment. We want our residents brought into the policymaking process early in the game and to play a relevant role in that development of policy. I'm not yet sure if the administration has equal clarity on the difference between informing and engaging and actually empowering. And so that's what I'll be looking for. I have no doubt that Councilman Hines was kind enough to mention the work Councilwoman Gonzalez Gutierrez's staff and mine have been doing, gathering input on registered neighborhood organizations. That's simply a piece of the puzzle. And the other thing I wanted to just throw in was, I hope we can, while I appreciate the aim has been But I would like us to be careful on how we abandon, how we bandy about that term, those same 12 people, because there's a lot of those same 12 people who are competent and dedicated to the good of our city. And so I would, rather than throw them away, my intention is to bring them into a much more equitable, inclusive process. Mm-hmm. And again, Councilwoman Lewis, thank you so much, and please put me on your briefing list. Thank you, Madam President.
Thank you. Awesome. All right, next up, changing directions, talking about a policy on mailing citations.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Rashawn.
Yeah, you're welcome. We'll be in touch.
So I wear it during sleep, but like if I wear my Apple Watch, someone will, I'll call someone when I sleep.
Council President, can we?
Yeah, go ahead. The floor is yours. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, colleagues, for giving me the opportunity to present about parking citations. If I were to encapsulate this just into a brief comment, today we have the authority, the City of Denver has the authority to mail moving citations. Currently, our ordinance does not give us that same flexibility with stationary citations. So if you get a parking ticket from a red light camera or a photo enforcement van, that citation can be mailed to you. But if you get a parking ticket, the parking ticket by ordinance must be affixed to the vehicle. So I want to talk about that disparity and why it's, I believe it's interesting and important for us to provide the flexibility to mail in parking citations just as we can mail in or mail moving vehicle citations. So right now the DRMC 547088 talks about that the citation shall conspicuously affix to such a vehicle, a notice or summons in writing. And that's really what we're looking at and hoping to address. The current process is has a few or four pretty big buckets. The first is if someone parks at a parking meter and the meter is expired, that would be a parking citation. Also, if someone is parking in an accessible space without a placard or plate identifying that they have the authority to use that space, there are also other parking spaces loading only, or residential parking, or 2-hour parking spaces. Those aren't necessarily a parking meter, but there are time restricted spaces as well. And another bucket's street sweeping days. So the general gist here is that our streets are owned by all the people. And we want to make sure that all the people have access both to where they want to go and access to that for only as long as they need. So the idea of a parking meter is to encourage people to use that limited resource for only as long as they need, and then make that space available for someone else as they may need the same space at a similar time. So the current ticketing system is a citation. The right-of-way enforcement agent often, or law enforcement or a peace officer, can generate a citation and print it on a handheld device. These handheld devices are not like an Apple Watch. These are something that costs like $40,000 or $50,000, as I understand it, in my research for. As you hopefully know, I've done a fair amount of research on citations of parking against people illegally accessing parking for people with disabilities. And we had, as Council Torres and I had talked about just a few weeks ago, we had a disability parking enforcement program that ultimately was disbanded because the DPEP, Disability Parking Enforcement Officer, or volunteers were using a paper system, and now all parking citations are issued using this handheld device. So I was thinking, oh, well, let's just give these handheld devices to these volunteers, and they are very expensive devices. So so you generate and print the citation on this device and then affix it to the vehicle door or windshield. Some of the challenges to the current process, it is a complex job to try to fit that value statement, encouraging people to use the people's resource for only as long as they need. It is throughout the entire city. We have safety and morale concerns. We'll see here in a minute the number of right-of-way enforcement officers who have been threatened and had to have the police come to engagements between someone who alleged, occupied a space when they shouldn't, and the right-of-way enforcement agent trying to cite that vehicle. As you probably know, it's difficult to hire right-of-way enforcement officers. It's a difficult job, and really, there's a lot of public demeaning of people who are right-of-way enforcement officers. Also, right-of-way enforcement agents, they have to purchase right-hand drive vehicles, which is a complicated process as well. So, writing the citations or printing the citations and affixing them often are inefficient and time-consuming. And while a right-of-way enforcement officer in that right-hand drive vehicle is printing the citation, they're also blocking traffic. So each right-of-way enforcement officer in our agent in Denver issues on average about 50 citations a day. So as of a little over a month ago, Roe here, right-of-way enforcement, has issued almost 250,000 citations for 2025. Here's part of the challenges. As I mentioned, since 2023, there have been 87 negative field interactions, and 14 of those required a police response. The solution, as I mentioned, instead of being required to affix a citation to a vehicle, we could allow for mailing the delivery of citations using first-class mail. We also want to make some conforming changes to the deadline process. Certainly, if we mail a citation, it's going to take a little bit longer to get to the individual, and we want to make sure that they have the opportunity to check their mail before there are any escalations in fine amounts. So in general, if you don't pay your parking ticket in a certain period of time, I believe it's 30 days, the fines go up, and then I think there's another escalation after that. There's no change to the fines levied or the adjudication process. I will mention this particular bullet point was before I learned about the parking magistrate's office, so we will have that conversation, I believe, in the budget process. I'll just leave that there for right now. I believe the result is that this will create more efficiency and a more cost-effective operation for right-of-way enforcement, and again, that value statement, ensuring people only use city's resources in a parking, on-street parking space for as long as they need. Second, if you're a right-of-way enforcement agent and someone is starting to complain, to put it very kindly, about the citation that this individual is creating, they can now have the opportunity to just disengage. And still that individual receives the citation, as opposed to having the right-of-way enforcement agent put their their personal safety on the line to try to affix a citation to a vehicle that might have a combative driver there. Also, there's the enhanced capacity to address accessible parking violations. This is something that I have talked about for quite some time. It was because of parking for people with disabilities that became politically motivated and engaged in Colorado. And so I'm happy to, I could talk about that all day. right before the pandemic, there was an industry group that oversees parking lots that named me their national spokesperson for the Accessible Parking Coalition. Then COVID kind of took that off the table, but certainly I've know quite a bit about accessible parking for people with disabilities. As I mentioned at the very beginning, this result would also align citywide citation delivery practices. So it doesn't matter if the vehicle is moving or stationary, the result of issuing the citation would be the same. It could be via mail. And some of the staffing challenges, knowing that they don't have, the agents don't have to put themselves in harm's way when affixing a citation, I believe will help with some of the staffing challenges. And also the fleet procurement is in the right-hand drive vehicles that right-of-way enforcement use. We would have less of a need for those vehicles. So, on its face, I think the ask is to allow us to mail in parking citations just as we currently mail in moving citations. That's it.
All right. So I have in the queue, I have Cashman, Torres, Alvidrez, DRC, Parity, and myself. Quinn? Okay.
Thank you. Councilman. Is it, I'm reading the draft, it looks like it's optional. You could mail it or you could put it on the vehicle, or what's the deciding factor?
I believe the deciding factor would be based on the enforcement agent. And we have Dottie here as well, by the way, if you want to ask Dottie directly. But it would be up to the discretion of the right-of-way enforcement agent if they want to affix to the vehicle. And I'll ask Dottie if they want to.
Okay, you're not suggesting we go universally to only by mail, correct?
I believe that is the case. Let's see if Dottie agrees.
Good afternoon, Adam Dietro, interim director for right-of-way enforcement. So to that question there, yes, we're not looking to go universally across the board with mailing citations. There are some situations where mailing a citation and just that workflow works better, like potentially a street sweeping situation where it's just one after the other after the other.
Those factors might be?
Sure. I think some of the more complex violations that we write that require additional evidence, additional pictures, and things like that might be more or would be more appropriate for a SERV citation on the vehicle versus, again, like a street sweeping where, it's a high volume. We're going from one vehicle to the next, to the next, to the next. It's much more efficient for us to just be able to mail, rather than sticking our arm out the window and affixing those to each vehicle.
Okay. Given the situation with the budget and the way the Department of Magistrates, at least for a while until there's some new process, I do have a concern about the ability of the person to be aware that they've been cited when they leave the parking spot if they don't have a ticket on the window, where they could have said, well, wait a minute, let me take a picture here, a timestamp picture, I still have time on the meter, or some such, whatever the evidence might be, so that they can then contest it. Whereas, a week, 2 weeks later, they get a ticket in the mail and they don't even remember what day that was, where did I go that day, because they go downtown every day or they park, whatever. So I do have a concern about our ability for timely notice of the violation. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Certainly we want to make sure that, people are innocent until proven guilty. And I think that there's a bit of a, if we have an agent that is being threatened then I think it, you know, I'd much rather them have the ability to disengage and still create the citation. And so I think from my perspective, the idea is to create more of a one uniform code for stationary moving citations, and also to protect protect our employees. So giving them the option doesn't mean that we would necessarily go, as already stated, to 100% mailing of citations.
Next up, we have Councilmember Cashman.
Madam President, appreciate it. Councilman Hines, thanks for bringing this forward. I have a number of questions that I'm guessing you may not have detail on, but if you can get back to me. I'm wondering how much it would end up costing to mail out the citations, and how much the program would end up costing under the new, sounds like might mail in, might fix directly program. How much does the citation program cost now, and what would be the difference? I'm just going to rattle these questions off, Councilman. You can answer if you've got any answers. If not, get back to me. How many of the citations on average actually get paid each year? I'm guessing there are plenty that the city never receives a response to. And how many citations are disputed due to errors at the time they're issued? Something like Councilman Flynn was talking about, maybe misread license plate numbers, incorrect time allowance. And finally, and this is, I guess, a question, I think, for Dottie. It's my understanding that the city is no longer issuing citations for violating the 72-hour parking rule, where I believe it used to be you had to move the car a certain number of feet. Can you clarify that for me, please?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question, Councilman. In regards to the 72-hour violation, prior to 2023, there was a requirement if somebody violated that, if they didn't move their vehicle within 72 hours, that they had to move their vehicle at least 100 feet. In 2023, the code changed to just being moved any distance, and so it's very difficult for us to enforce that when a vehicle is only required to move 10 feet, 5 feet in some cases. So so that's why we are not actively enforcing that violation at this point.
Thank you for that. I think that's something maybe we want to look at while I want to not torture folks that are not, that are parking in front of their own home or just need a little flexibility. But we do get a continuing a flood of complaints about people parking vehicles for long periods of time that don't live in the area. And I think having the ability to issue citations might be something we'd want to consider. But Councilman, if you could get together with Dottie and get the answers to those dollar questions, I'd greatly appreciate it, sir.
Thank you, Councilmember. You're right. I don't have the expense side. I have done some analysis on the revenue side as we've determined that we've got some right-of-way enforcement agent openings that we're not going to replace. And so I've talked with Dottie and the mayor's office about our budget by eliminating right-of-way enforcement agent positions. We're saving money on the budget side, but because it's their cost centers, the agents, but of course they create revenue by issuing citations on average 50 a day. So so that's I think, in my opinion, a short-sighted determination to eliminate our revenue generators. And I will say the reason why we have right-of-way enforcement agents is to ensure people use that limited resource for a period of time, and to deter people who are not using the resource appropriately. We have them to deter behavior, not to generate revenue. It just so happens that we have a we get revenue in the process of deterring behavior. But I'll.
We have Councilman Torres with Parity on deck. No, it's Alvidres on deck, sorry.
Okay, thank you. I think, follow up with other municipalities who've already got this and kind of how it's working. I'd be curious if contesting your ticket happens more or maybe less frequently if you get it in the mail, like with speeding tickets, right, or red light camera tickets. One of your slides, I think 7, talks about enhanced capacity to address ADA parking violations. I remember the auditor's audit in 2015, 2016 in HRCP. There was discussion, and so I want to know where you're headed with that piece. Is that of public parking facilities or private parking facilities? Because we need to understand, I think, the distinction. Are we asking in the future to send right-of-way to, like, King Super's parking lots or rec center parking lots, right, where somebody might be occupying a disability parking space? Because I know that the DPEP used to do private lots, and it becomes a really difficult thing, I think, for me to understand where do we enforce as a city, as opposed to private enforcement of parking spaces. Just curious, like where that's at.
Yeah. The state has two different categories of lots: public lots and private lots. The city has three categories of lots: public, private, and private available for the public. So you mentioned King Super. So grocery store would be a privately owned lot, but available for the public. So just to kind of set the stage for the response, I think initially the idea here is that we're talking about city-owned assets, so public lots. You're right, DPEP would go on to grocery store lots. What was even more, because we had three different buckets, we also had an even more kind of murkier conversation about what about apartment buildings or apartment parking lots? Because for a while, no one was going on to parking lots for apartment buildings and issuing citations for improperly parking in an accessible parking space.
So, and I feel like it was agreed that the police department were the ones who had, were the only ones that could have that authority. And the time that they have to go and patrol apartment parking lots is pretty low. I do have interest in just understanding that question a little bit more. And because I think the ADA also distinguishes differently between public and private as well. So that would be interesting for me, because is it still a $300 fine?
$350.
Yeah, it's pretty substantial.
Yeah, so the state law requires there be a graduation of fines. The first citation is a $350 fine. The second citation is a $500 fine. Third citation is a $1,000 fine. And fourth and subsequent are 1,000 and 10 hours of community service. Some people could charge them money all day and they don't care.
We don't do that graduation.
Correct.
Okay.
State law says we have to, we're not. So I'll just kind of leave that there. Also, the state law is clear that that a peace officer can issue citations on public or private lots, right, and that a private lot, if a private lot owner installs the paint and sign that says that this is a reserved space, then they shall give permission for a peace officer to enter private property and issue those citations. The challenge is that right-of-way enforcement agents are not peace officers. Peace officer is a special term, as in like law enforcement. And so that, I think that's what you were what you were talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Councilwoman Alvidres.
Thank you. I will just say I am concerned about this, especially without parking magistrates and not knowing how people are supposed to pay their tickets or get dispute their tickets right now. So I will just share that. But one of my questions is, what if someone moves or they have an out-of-state address or they have changed their address and it gets mailed to the wrong place and they end up with a warrant because they have an unpaid ticket?
Yeah. I do have concerns about the parking, the dissolution of the parking magistrate's office. I didn't know that was going away until I started getting emails from constituents. So I agree. As far as where people, what if people move or they have an address, they don't update their driver's license, you know, the law is you have to update your new address within 90 days. What happens if that doesn't happen? I don't have an immediate answer to that, but I know that we do the same process with moving citations. I don't know if, Dottie, do you have a, do you know what the process is for when, like a photo enforcement man, if they mail the citation and it turns out it's not a current address? Is that something that you work on? Okay, so I don't know the immediate answer, but I can find out.
Okay, the last thing I would ask from Dottie is if you could provide data over the last year of where citations have been given and what dollar amounts. I'm curious to see, are we targeting certain neighborhoods? Is it being unfairly targeted towards certain areas? So I would love to see that data. Thank you.
Thank you.
And council member, one thing I've just about parking for, you know, accessible parking citations, should stop fidgeting with my glasses. Right-of-way enforcement agents reported that there was a gold mine in front of or at, on the Denver Health Campus, that there were, you could station a right-of-way enforcement agent to just go around the Denver Health Campus and they would issue accessible parking violations all day. So in some ways that might be an equity consideration. Also in some ways that might be there are more people who go to the hospital who need those spaces. So as I certainly agree, we should get that data. Sometimes I just want to help us kind of interpret the data too, so that we don't look at it on its face and go, oh, yay, or oh, boo.
I think he's done.
Okay. Councilwoman Pro Tem Romero-Kembo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually had, my questions have been asked, so I know we're running short on time, but again, just the notification, I worry about people not knowing that they've been ticketed and then being able to, you know, dispute that ticket. So, and general cost, which I think is already on the list. So thank you, Madam President. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Just a quick comment, because I shared the same concern, and I had the opportunity to have a very brief conversation with folks in Dottie about the new process for with the absence of the magistrates. And to be completely honest with you, it's not very well spelled out at all, not yet. And they don't anticipate that it will be until sometime in January. And so just kind of want to flag that as I asked if they could bring a presentation to the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee so that council members can know like what that process is going to be. So it's just more of a flag than anything.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the flag. Yeah.
Thank you. I have a lot of concerns about this proposal. One of them is when I was talking to Director Ford from Dottie, I asked her, would we be getting rid of high-level parking enforcement and putting a low-level hourly person? Because you still have to get the piece of paper, put it in an envelope, and match the citation. It doesn't just magically go somewhere. It actually goes to a processing center. So we would be getting rid of higher-paid employees and bringing in lower-paid employees to do that paperwork processing, because you still have to have the person who make sure that the printed citation is the one that matches on the screen, that goes in the envelope, that goes out to the person. And I have concerns for a lot of my council district, not a lot, but a big portion of my council district has, in Jefferson Park, they don't have mailboxes that go straight to them. You have to actually go out and pick up your mail. And so people usually go out and pick up their mail like once a week or once every other week. And then if they get a parking ticket, and so what happens, like no one, it's disputed and you're like, it wasn't there. And oftentimes my staff, where they have to park in front of Platt Street all the time, we have more conversations with the parking people that are down there, and they oftentimes mix up input, like they'll switch license plates number inaccurately, they'll switch things, and I just have a lot of concern that I think that as much as we're trying to streamline this, that they're actually the benefit, would it wouldn't bring a benefit to the residents of Denver. I think if we did something like this, all of our inboxes are going to blow up and say, we didn't get this parking ticket, I wasn't there. And then oftentimes, if you're going down a street and you start seeing a slew of parking tickets, and then you stop and read the sign and you're like, oh, it's street sweeping today, I got to move my car. So it's also a visual deterrent. So I could just see more complaints coming about with this process than not. And then thinking about future generations, if we do change the revised municipal code, who's to say that one day they won't just do 100% mail-in tickets? And the difference between photo radar enforcement is you get your picture taken, so you can validate that somebody's driving that car. This is just a agent out there with a tool saying, we're going to give you a tight citation because you are parked in your meter expired or something like that. And as not to beat a dead horse, but with the parking magistrates gone, we can't even like have anyone go and write a parking ticket. You have to go and set a time, and if you lose, you have to pay $27 to pay for the court fee and then your ticket. So I think that we're adding a little bit of burden to our residents in a time where I don't want to add more burden.
Yeah. So I already highlighted the one particular item where, when I was coming up with this, was before I learned that the parking magistrate was dissolved, and so I have concerns about that. So to my constituents, we've gotten several people concerned about receiving a parking violation and not being able to contest it without showing up in person to schedule it, showing up in person again to go to court. So that's in addition to the court fee. Having to go in person to schedule and go to court is also a burden. So as far as whether the right-of-way enforcement agent does or does not provide photographic evidence, that could be a conversation we have as well with Dottie and with counsel. I would not be opposed to requiring photographic evidence of a parking citation too, so that we have that. But that's a conversation I'd be happy to have with colleagues and with Dottie.
So it sounds like this needs lots of different next steps. It's not ready to move on to committee yet at this time. So why don't you circle back around with Luke, and we'll get you back on the budget and policy list and see where we are with the parking magistrates, and to Councilman Lewis's point, figure out, have a briefing and see what actually ends up happening there, because I've heard the same thing. It's very raw. They're trying to figure this out right now. It's true. I had the same conversation. That's real. Okay. Thank you all. I'll give you 4 minutes back and we'll stand adjourned, and I'll see you at 3:30. Thank you.
You are gonna